Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Judge Sleater is substituting for Judge Bjorkman on this case. I will be the presiding judge just for this case. Counsel will each have 15 minutes for argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you can please introduce yourself and the party you represent when you begin your argument, we would appreciate it. And feel free to adjust the podium as necessary. Judge Sleater is here, and you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nord Hunt, and I represent the appellant cross respondent United Fire and Casualty Company. Appellant United Fire issued a comprehensive general liability insurance policy, known as a CGL policy, to Lambert Construction. In respondent King's Cove's lawsuit against Lambert, King Cove asserted that due to Lambert's negligence, breach of contract, breach of warranty, the exterior walls, roof, insulation installed by Lambert needed to be replaced. Lambert and King's Cove then entered into a $2 million settlement, agreeing that it could only be collectible against United Fire, and which judgment the trial court has now ordered United Fire to pay. The trial court was wrong in so ordering, and the trial court committed reversible error for a multitude of reasons, as detailed in United Fire's briefs to this court, and United Fire relies on its briefing. But in the short time available, I would like to concentrate on the issue of insurance coverage, which presents an issue of law for this court. As this court is well aware, CGL policies are not performance bonds. There are specific parameters that must be met before an insurer provides indemnity coverage for construction-related damages. A prerequisite is that there be property damage caused by an occurrence. An occurrence is defined as an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful conditions. The term accident is not defined in the policy, but our Minnesota Supreme Court has defined accident as an unexpected, unforeseen, or undesigned happening or consequence from either a known or unknown cause. Whereas here, Lambert walks off the job before it finished its work because King Cove has failed to pay its bill. And as a result, Lambert has intentionally left gaps that allow water intrusion. Any resulting property damage from that water intrusion is not caused by an occurrence.
Ms. Hunt, can I inquire procedurally? I noticed there was a declaratory judgment action regarding the coverage filed, but it appeared that the judge addressed the issue of coverage in the summary judgment order. What happened to the declaratory judgment? Why, procedurally, why did it happen in that order?
Because of the garnishment. So what happened was there was a declaratory judgment action started before there was the settlement, the Miller-Shugart settlement. And so what happened then is with that settlement, it went into the garnishment action. And so it really became the coverage was determined in the garnishment action, because now we're talking about $2 million seeking indemnification from United Fire.
Your client's position, you believe, was effectively at least addressed, although unsuccessfully, in the summary judgment portion of the garnishment amended action.
Right. So the coverage was addressed by the motion for partial summary judgment brought by King's Cove in the garnishment action, right?
The burdens of proof, I gathered, shifted somewhat by going to the garnishment action as opposed to the deck action.
Right, they did, and it was on King's Cove. And part of the problem in this case is,
did you just abandon the deck action then, or what happened?
Well, it was left in abeyance, and I think eventually it was closed by judicial action at the end of this, but it just was left out there. But the coverage then moved into the garnishment action, and it's framed by that $2 million Miller-Shugart judgment, for which King's Cove is claiming there's indemnity coverage for that $2 million under United Fire's policy.
Do you believe it's, agree it's undisputed that that $2 million refers only to Lambert's involvement or alleged involvement in the condition of the building and so forth? In
other absolutely.
Words, the subcontractors were left separate from that.
Right, absolutely. So what they did was in their Miller-Shugart, they said they carved out rail and the concrete and took that out, and that they proceeded against rail. They actually went to trial against rail. And as to Lambert, they limited to the roofing and siding and specifically excluded out anything related to concrete. So the $2 million we're talking about the roofing and siding work of Lambert.
So in the, but in the summary judgment order, the district court focused on the fact that subcontractors were included in exclusion L. Why do you think the district court did that?
Because it committed error. Because that was specifically, United Fire was specific in response to King's Cove that that's out of the case because we're talking now in the context of this garnishment of the $2 million framed by the Miller-Shugart.
Everybody recognized that at that point that there was going to be no coverage for those items, and that's why it was out?
The concrete? No, that was because they were going against rail for the concrete. So that's why. So what they...
Separate suit, you mean?
Right. Well, it was actually, they were a party. So what happened was, after they settled with Lambert, there were still claims. They carved out their claims against rail, who did the concrete. And actually, Lambert and rail had cross claims. And actually, United Fire continued to defend Lambert as that went on. But the concrete was specifically not part of the $2 million settlement. And it's explicit in the Miller-Shugart, and that's why I've directed the court's attention to the documents that King's Cove filed when rail was arguing, well, no, the concrete was part of the settlement, and they said no. As to Lambert, all of this $2 million is the siding and the roof.
So what's this argument about the failure to allocate the damages? I mean, if in fact the concrete was out already, I'm helping understand.
Okay. The problem with allocation is when you're talking about construction defect litigation, it's complex. And it's complex when you apply it to insurance coverage. So when you're talking about allocation, you need to allocate what you claim are covered damages and what are non-covered. So non-covered, because of your standard business pursuit exclusions, are damage to your work. So any repair or replacement claim damages to Lambert's own work is excluded under the policy, under exclusion L.
So but that actually, wasn't, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But that wasn't excluded in the Miller-Shugart.
No, I mean, it wasn't.
Explicitly wasn't, anyway.
Right, and so, and our argument is that, well, any repair damages are excluded under excluded L, and everything is excluded. But they're arguing about ceiling tile and wet carpeting, which is they damaged other property, but that nowhere shows up in the Miller-Shugart.
So the district court in the summary judgment order didn't recognize the exclusion for your work in exclusion L, and as a result didn't consider that in analyzing whether this agreement was reasonable. Is that
That's
accurate?
Correct. Right, because King's Cove had this argument, which started really before the Miller-Shugart, continued in their motion for leave to file a supplemental complaint, is in their supplemental complaint, and was made in their motion for summary judgment that somehow there was this separate products completed operation hazard coverage, and therefore the business risk exclusions such as exclusion L do not apply. Now, in their briefing to this, and we've argued that's error, we've listed for the court the commentators' cases from around the country saying that's not how you read the policy. And so exclusion L is in play. But In their briefing to this court, I don't see any response to that, to United Fire's argument. And as far as I can see, they've abandoned the argument, which is really kind of the structure of how they were somehow claiming all of this was covered. And so what we are here before the court is, I mean, that was error. And the exclusions are in place. And exclusion L does exclude any damages to repair or replace Lambert's own work.
So, Ms. Hunt, do you believe on that issue of allocation of covered versus uncovered, and both parties referenced the Corn Plus case, though not directly precedential, do you believe that that case and its proposition that a Miller-Shugart must allocate between covered and uncovered, otherwise it's per se or as a matter of law unreasonable, do you believe that's an accurate statement of Minnesota law?
That's an accurate statement of Minnesota law. I have, in fact, represented Corn Plus and lost that case. But
so you should have lost, in other words, by your argument today. In other words.
But in Corn Plus, the Eighth Circuit relied on the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Borman. It relied on this court's decision in Ebenezer versus Drivet. So it was predicated, and the Hangslaven case. So it was predicated on clear precedent, both by the Minnesota Supreme Court and this court. And so what you have in these kind of cases, what you can't do is come in and just kind of throw this out and say, here it is. The courts, this court and the Supreme Court says, no, you've got to tell us damage item by damage item so that we can then square it up. And so as the Eighth Circuit said in Corn Plus, it's so you can't come back in later and say, oh, no, I had this other stuff was included in there. So that's why, I mean, you look at the Miller-Shugart, I mean, there's nothing there about damage to other property. It's for the repair of Lambert's own work, roof, and siding. What's interesting is if the court would take...
Your position is that is excluded, correct?
Correct.
And because the Miller-Shugart doesn't differentiate between covered and uncovered or excluded claims...
The Miller-Shugart is unenforceable.
Now, in our review of the Miller-Shugart, what is the standard of review that applies?
The standard of review, it would be a question of law.
Notwithstanding the Alton M. Johnson case because of this underlying question
about...
When
you move into the reasonableness, when you're moving into looking at that, then that moves into that area. But when you're talking whether the Miller-Shugart on its face, because it doesn't allocate, that is a question of law, which is what the Supreme Court did in Hangslaven. It's in Ebenezer, it was a probable cause issue, and the court there found no probable cause because it didn't allocate, which again would be a question of law. So it's always been a question of law.
But Corn Plus described it as being the absence of the allocation meant that the agreement was unreasonable as a matter of law.
Right. Correct. Correct. So it's a if you don't allocate, that takes away the Miller-Shugart. It's unenforceable.
Tell me what the rationale for that is. You know, the court said the logic of it, but didn't explain the compelling logic.
Okay.
What's the logic of that?
The logic of it is that you need to know, and the court needs to know, what is being settled. What are the damage items by number? What is going into that $2 million?
So that somebody can't bring some other items in later?
Exactly. So you know exactly by item. And so, and if you look at what they did here, what they did is they went to Ermater's report, which is at, if I can find the reference here, it is... Document 100, which is Exhibit 12 to King Cove's affidavit in support of summary judgment on coverage. And the numbers, so for example, in the Miller Shugart, $162,000 is assigned to the roof. If you look at Ermeter's report, there's some tables, and one is entitled Upper Roof, and that lists a number of items for removal and replacement of the roof at a total cost of $162,224. What's interesting is all of those numbers are for repair or replacement of Lambert's own work. There's nothing in there.
And that's excluded.
And that's excluded. But see, their whole argument always was that the exclusions didn't apply because of this products completed operation hazard coverage, which doesn't exist. It's under coverage A, and the exclusions apply. So, I mean, the whole way this case was formatted with regard to coverage was an error, and that's why the court must reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Respondent?
Good morning. My name is Stephen Waters, and I represent Kings Cove Marina in connection with this matter. And I'd first like to remind the court that there is a very deferential standard of review here for the court to consider in looking at these issues. And I wanted to first clarify a couple of points that came up here. And first of all, Lambert did not leave the building with windows open and intending to cause damage. The facts shown, including our citation in the record at our respondent's appendix 30, is that Lambert made the openings in the window. The windows were installed by a third party, and then Lambert came back and installed the flashing. The project was abandoned by Lambert at some point in time over a dispute over his failure to order the necessary materials to complete the project, and he did not complete the project, but the building has been put to use. And the issue that we have is Lambert clearly did work on this project, and Lambert clearly brought in a subcontractor, Rail, for the work for the concrete on the main and mezzanine levels. And as the court found in this case, the issue is not was Lambert a general contractor. The issue is, was Rail a subcontractor of Lambert? Because if he is, then there's coverage under this subpart L exclusion for work of the subcontractor.
Doesn't the Miller Shugart agreement, though, by its terms, exclude any claims against the concrete contractor?
No. In this case, the Miller Shugart agreement was an agreement that excluded all claims by Kings Cove against Lambert. And the expressly provides and broadly provides the parties now wish to fully compromise, settle, and resolve all claims between themselves that relate or arise out of the underlying suit pursuant to the terms and conditions set forth herein. And then it goes on. Lambert is discharged from its liability for claims and damages, including but not limited to, and it goes on. And then it goes on to provide that Lambert is released from all liability. And the court found...
And what page in the addendum are you looking at?
That would be addendum pages 51 and 57. And then when...
At page 56, paragraph 5A, it says, this settlement agreement between Lambert and Kings Cove is not intended to provide compensation for damages and losses sustained by Kings Cove Marina arising from work and operations of roll construction on the main level and mezzanine level of the building, including damages and losses for the demolition and reconstruction of the mezzanine, its structural support, floors, and interior offices, or demolition and reconstruction of the main level floor and related damages or costs. So doesn't that language exclude any damages relating to roll construction and the concrete?
You have to read it with a distinction between the direct liability of Rail and the vicarious and direct liability of Lambert. And under the agreement, Lambert has direct liability for the roofing and siding. Rail has direct liability for the concrete. Lambert, it's undisputed, as the court found in its reasonableness determination, that Lambert hired Rail for the work on the concrete work on the main and mezzanine levels. That finding is not clearly erroneous. And the Miller-Shugart agreement releases all the liability of Lambert, which and then includes his, not his direct liability, but also his vicarious liability as the general contractor, or excuse me, as the contractor that hired Rail. And as the court in its ruling in this case pointed out, that vicarious liability of Lambert was real, because when eventually the claim against the concrete contractor, Rail, went to trial, Lambert, who didn't do the work, was found 93% at fault for that.
Mr. Waters, isn't it, if I understand the structure of this, again, because this was only an agreement with Lambert, and so it involves Lambert's liability up to that point, and there's separate litigation going on with the concrete and, I believe, the other subcontractor.
Yes.
So I'm not sure I'm following the explanation you're providing as to, would it be safe to say, at a minimum, the Miller-Shugart $2 million involves liability of Lambert?
It involved all liability of Lambert, direct and vicarious.
So if it involved all liability of Lambert, and we're not talking about the subcontractors, how does the subcontractor exclusion of the exclusion apply?
Because the court found that the Miller-Shugart agreement was, in effect, a Perringer release. And the court found, in granting the motion by Lambert for summary judgment, that it has all the hallmarks of a Perringer release. Therefore, Lambert had no liability for that 93% that it was later found liable. So the Miller-Shugart, when you construe it, had the effect of being a Perringer release, which released all the liability of Lambert, direct and vicarious, and that's how the agreement should be interpreted.
Let's turn to the other part of exclusion L, not the exception for the subcontractor, but the actual exclusion, which is for property damage to your work. In your brief at page 36, it appears that you agree that that exclusion bars coverage, and I'll just quote, you say, first, exclusion L bars coverage for damage to the insured's own work completed where the work itself is the cause of the damage. So it appears to me in my reading of your brief that you are now in agreement that exclusion L bars coverage for damage to Lambert's own work.
And with your work, which is limited to his work, which in this case does not include damage to the interior finishes, to the sheetrock, ceiling tiles, insulation, carpet, all studs, all of those materials that are inside. And then we do look then, as the trial court found and as we included in our brief, to the product's completed operation hazard coverage. The United Fire policy here on the declaration page has a provision that says it's a general aggregate limit of $2 million and a products completed operation hazard coverage limit of $2 million. That means that coverage provides coverage for work that is completed, abandoned, or put to its intended use that occurs away from the contractor's own premises. And it's very broad. It includes damage to any property, which in this case would include the contractor's own work as well as damage to other property. So under the product's completed operation, the court has to construe that as having some meaning here in this policy. Otherwise, it would be illusory.
But doesn't the language of exclusion L exclude from the product's completed operations hazard property damage to your own work? It says
exclusion L has that provision in there. The exclusion before that, exclusion J6, provides the coverage under the product's completed operation under an exception under paragraph exclusion J6. J6 of the policy provides that there's an exclusion for that part of any property that must be restored, repaired, or replaced because your work was incorrectly performed on it. But then it goes on at the end, paragraph 6 of this exclusion does not apply to property damage included in the product's completed operation hazard. So that reinstates the coverage under the product's completed operation hazard. And when you then look at the definition of what the product's completed operation hazard is, that includes, it includes property damage occurring away from the premises you own or rent and arising out of your work or your product. And it goes on to say that there's an exception, but it, the exception then has a but, and the but is important. Work that has not yet been completed or abandoned. However, your work will be deemed completed at the earliest of the following. And then it goes on under subparagraph 2C. When that part of the work done at a job site has been put to its intended use by any person or organization other than another contractor or subcontractor. And it's undisputed here, Kings Cove has been using the building since then. And it goes on to provide another one. When that work that may need service, maintenance, correction, repair, or replacement, but which is otherwise complete will be treated as completed. So under the product's completed operation hazard, there is coverage for the your work. Under the subcontractor exception L, there's coverage for the work that Lambert's vicarious liability for the work of its sub rail, regardless of whether Lambert was a general or not. He clearly was a contractor on the project and brought in rail, and therefore there's coverage there under the policy for Lambert's liability is vicarious liability for the work of its sub, for the work under the product's completed operation for its work, and it's there's also coverage under the your work exclusion for damage to other property resulting from the work of the contractor.
Now, we've had some discussion this morning about Corn Plus and Ebenezer and Borson. You want to respond to the discussion we had?
Well, the point that the court raised is what is the rationale of that allocation? And there's two points here. You start with from the proposition that, number one, I think when you read the Miller-Shugart, there is an allegation. Now, in this case, United Fire denied all coverage.
You think there's an allocation?
Pardon?
Thinking it doesn't make it, so tell us how it's an allocation.
The allocation is, for there to be an allocation, the allocation has to be between covered and uncovered losses. And as the trial court found on its coverage decision, which should be affirmed here, there is coverage for all the damages here. So there is no reason to allocate. But even if there is the allocation issue, the rationale for that, as you pointed out, goes to the issue of reasonableness. So something that's not covered is included in there. And the question here is, given the amount of the Miller-Shugart agreement, which is substantially less than the total exposure, which the court found to be $4.4 to $5.2 million, and that Lambert's direct share of that was $2.4 to $2.8 million. When you have a Miller-Shugart that's less than the total exposure, less than Lambert's direct liability, down to the figure of $2 million, the court found that that was entirely reasonable under the circumstances.
Mr. Waters, can I just clarify that? Does that not presuppose then the court would have to agree, if I understood you correctly, exception L does not apply at all to any, not even $1 of damage in the $2 million cited in the Miller-Shugart?
The exclusion L provides coverage for Lambert's vicarious liability, and it provides...
But I'm referring to the exclusion for work that he did, which clearly your client alleged was defective.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be safe to say there's at least a portion, therefore, of the $2 million allocation in the Miller-Shugart, which would be excluded and for which there's no allocation identified in the Miller-Shugart.
Well, if the Lambert share was 2.4 to 2.8, so we've reduced it down to $2 million. So the amount of the Miller-Shugart allocated out any damages for Lambert's own work.
But doesn't the Miller-Shugart have to identify what those damages from Lambert's own work are that are not covered? Or is it your position? I mean, I know, or is it your position that because everything is covered, there wasn't a need to do that?
Well, we reduced it to make sure that it was reasonable.
But how do we know that? I mean, where is there a breakdown between the your work damages and the other damages?
Because Lambert's direct share was as spelled out in the Miller-Shugart is 2.4 to 2.8. So the Miller-Shugart is
so four. How do we know that your work is only worth $400,000 to $800,000.
Well, the entire project and the work that was billed by Lambert was less than the difference there. Even if you use the lowest figure, the 2.4, the work done by Lambert was less than that. So it's allocated out of that down to the $2 million. Because the purpose of the...
But the... Isn't that... I'm sorry.
Well, maybe I was going to ask the same question, and I know we're over time, but I'd allow you to answer the question, or at least...
No, go ahead.
The purpose, as I understand, of the Miller-Shugart is to limit the liability of the insured who signs it. So we're assuming then, therefore, by that dollar amount, his liability was limited to $2 million, of which the insurer shall pay.
Correct.
Now, if I understand your answer correctly, you've already reduced it. The phrase you used, it's already been reduced... What the already reduced, I understand, referred to the other liability of the other subcontractors, which then the total might reach $4.5 million or some other number that I saw in the documents. I'm not sure I follow that, but it...
Well, you can follow it by if you look at the Lambert share, direct share, what's spelled out as and found by the court is 2.4 to 2.8. That's his direct share. His vicarious liability is the difference between that up to the 4.4 and 5.2.
At what point then would the insurer be able to implement the way the scenario is, which it is arguing, the exception L?
The exception L here provides coverage for damage to other property and provides coverage for the liability for the work of the subcontractor. And the product completed operation coverage provides coverage for Lambert's own work.
Any further questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
You want to respond to counsel's last conclusion that by reason of the figures that are present in the court's order and are in the Miller-Shugart, that there was no reason to further allocate?
I don't understand his response because... What we're looking at is...
What I think he is saying is that the items that would be excluded under L have been excluded in coming to the Miller-Shugart settlement.
Well, that's fine, but we're still talking about $2 million.
And if that's true, then there's no reason to allocate anymore.
Well, but there is reason to allocate if...
I'm paraphrasing what I think he said.
Right, okay. The problem is this. Is that all of this is not covered, the $2 million coverage, or exclusion L applies to Lambert's own work. Even under the judge talks about the insulation. Well, the insulation was Lambert's own work and would be excluded under L.
What about counsel's argument, though, that the product's completed operation coverage applies to their own work, and therefore it's not excluded.
Right, and that's exactly what I was saying in my initial comments, that argument wasn't in their brief. What they're arguing is that products completed operations hazard is a separate form of coverage, not under coverage A, and not subject to the business risks exclusion, such as exclusion L. The courts have rejected that. The commentators have rejected it. And actually, if you look at the policy and you look at Section 2, Sub 3, it lists the policy's limits of insurance, and it lists the product's completed operation aggregate limit as the most we will pay under coverage A. And so there is no basis for this argument with regard to exclusion L doesn't apply. And that was really what they were arguing to the trial court. Judge Klopacki, going back to the issue of allocation, the problem is when, if you have, assuming you have an occurrence and you're looking at these various business risk exclusions, it excludes any damage to the repair or replacement or removal of the insured's own work. But if there's damage to other property, such as a ceiling tile, that could be covered. And so that's why you allocate between covered and non-covered, so you know what in the world we're talking about in terms of how you're getting to this $2 million figure, and so you can't come in the back door. Now, if you look at this Miller-Shugart, it talks only about the repair and replacement costs of Lambert's own work. And if you flip over to document 100, which is the Ermatur report, there is nothing assigned in there as to damage to other property to Lambert. I mean, so really all of this should be excluded in the case done for that reason as well. Also, in my brief, I told the court to go back and read document 166. It's the King's Cove's memorandum of law in opposition to Rail's construction motion for summary judgment. What happened was, is after this Miller-Shugart and after the court's coverage ruling, Rail came in and said, well, we're out of here. And King's Cove said, no, under our Miller-Shugart agreement, we settled our claims against Lambert's for damages attributed to the roof and siding and preserved our separate claim against Rail for the main and mezzanine level damages. There's nothing about any kind of vicarious liability. That's the first, this morning is the first I've heard those terms. That's not what the Miller-Shugart said. That doesn't conform in any respect to how you analyze coverage. And so we ask that this court reverse.
Is this issue of allocated and unallocated coverage not being delineated in a Miller-Shugart agreement something that comes up frequently in your practice or in your experience, or is this kind of an unusual Miller-Shugart in that regard?
It comes up in construction litigation. I mean, if you go back to Miller-Shugart, it was a simple auto accident case. Once you try to morph Miller-Shugart into construction litigation defect, where you have all these exclusions and your their business risk exclusions, that's where the allocation comes in. And all of the cases I've cited to the court are construction defect litigation cases. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The matter was well briefed and well argued. We will look at it carefully.
All words in person in the back.